The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
They are not focused on collecting, analyzing, or providing intelligence that is giving our businesses, you know, some type of economic advantage. This is not to say that law enforcement or intelligence organizations don't sometimes provide information to businesses about threats, but that's done to protect against known or suspected illicit activity targeting a particular company or group of companies. That information is not given by the government, at least in my experience, to give it an economic advantage. It's given to protect it from nefarious activity.
I'm Quinta Jurassic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 1st, 2020. American companies are in a bind. So argue Bill Priestap and Holden Triplett, who have written a series of articles for Lawfare, making the case that more and more state intelligence agencies are turning their attention to private businesses, using the tools of espionage in order to build their own economic power. Both writers are speaking from experience. Priestap ran the FBI's counterintelligence division from 2015 to 2018, and Triplett led the FBI office in Beijing from 2014 to 2017 and was deputy head of the office in Moscow from 2012 to 2014. We brought them on the podcast to discuss why countries have started to use their intelligence services in this way, what dangers this creates for American businesses, and why counterintelligence risks might be hard to intuitively understand. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 1st. Why businesses need to take espionage seriously. I wanted to start off just by situating our listeners in the subject we're talking about. So intelligence and counterintelligence. Would you mind just explaining to our listeners what your backgrounds in the area are? Bill, let's start with you and then Holden.
Sure. Well, about a year and a half ago, I retired from the FBI as the head of counterintelligence, which means I was responsible for the FBI's counterintelligence operations worldwide. And I had been with the FBI for 21 years when I retired.
So I resigned from the FBI at the end of August of this year. I had been at the FBI for about 15 years. I held various positions in counterintelligence. I was the deputy head in Moscow. I was the head of the office in Beijing. And then I was the director for counterintelligence at the National Security Council.
So we're talking about a series of articles you've written for Lawfare about how state intelligence services around the world, particularly Chinese intelligence services, but not exclusively, are increasingly turning their tools against private businesses as well as other states. And you're arguing that this is a new trend and that businesses are in large part unprepared to grapple with it. So how did you come to see and understand this trend from your work at the FBI or otherwise?
Well, we both certainly saw this type of activity and were dealing with it on a very regular basis while in our government positions. And so that really was our first exposure to these issues. Since I have left government, again, over the last year and a half, there's nothing that I've seen in the private sector and public sector that basically has changed my mind as far as the gravity of this problem. In effect, at least what is publicly available, the problem seems, if anything, to be gaining momentum.
Well, I think maybe try to give a little bit of historical context. I mean, of course, there's always been things like industrial espionage and people, you know, using kind of various techniques to try to take secrets from other businesses. But what we really saw a major shift in the last couple of years is, and to be clear, the governments have been doing that, certain governments for decades. But what's really changed is the focus, right? So in years past, where, you know, typically government intelligence services are focused on plans and intentions of other governments, right? So one government stealing from another government to figure out what they're trying to do. It's been a slow progression, but there's been kind of a shift where the most valuable assets, at least as evaluated by other countries, are no longer in the government. They're in the private sector. They're economic assets. And the reason this shift has taken place, we believe, is because there is a larger kind of competition that's sort of beginning at this point, right? And everyone sort of learned kind of one of the key lessons from the Cold War, which is economic security it promotes national security, and that you need to have that in order to be secure nationally. And so that they are focused on really trying to obtain those economic assets that are out there to ensure that they have that economic security. And they're not in the government anymore. They're in the private sector. And so while in years past, some companies and others have had to deal with this on an ad hoc basis, it's really changed to where this is kind of a permanent fixture of the environment now. And they really need to understand this is the context within which they're doing business. It isn't sort of a nuisance that's going to pop up every now and then. This is going to be something that they need to constantly think about and be vigilant at protecting their assets against.
I want to make this maybe a little concrete for listeners, because what you said and part of what you're arguing is that this idea is in a way kind of very abstract, which makes it hard to hold on to and hard to conceptualize the danger. So if we're describing a dynamic where some countries are sort of seeking to use tools of state power, in particular espionage, to help their own economic growth, and that's harming private enterprises in other countries, specifically in the United States, could you give an example of what that looks like?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the easiest way to look at this is just for the most straightforward example. You see a number of cases that emerge from this, either prosecuted by the Department of Justice and investigated by the FBI, is that they will use their spy services to go out and actually take these assets. Now, the specifics of how they do that kind of vary, right? You can look at a lot of the cases. People tend to focus on cyber and the threat that, you know, comes through the computer. But actually, a great number of the cases aren't a sophisticated, you know, hacking or any type of intrusion. They may involve some amount of intrusion on the IT system for a company. But in many cases, they actually involve a human at some point. And so there's a couple of different avenues in which countries can use to go after companies' assets. But a lot of what we're seeing is sort of the tried and true method of using people. And using essentially spies to recruit individuals on the inside of companies to provide this information. Sometimes they use blackmail and sometimes they use bribery. So, you know, either a carrot or a stick in order to get that information, but they often are focused on using on the people. Unfortunately, a lot of times it's sort of misdiagnosed as everything's a cyber problem. I think that comes from the fact that, you know, a lot of the information is contained, or all the information most of the time is contained on a computer and people are using computers. So the key difference here is to understand is, you know, is the vulnerability within your company, is it a person or is it an IT system, right? So if you have someone on the inside that took the information, the fact that they did it with a thumb drive or they did it via their computer doesn't make it a cyber issue. That's a human issue, right? So if there was a sophisticated hack from the outside and no one from the inside of your company was involved, then that might be purely a cyber issue. And in most cases, it's never pure one side or the other. It's a mixture of both. So it becomes a little bit difficult sometimes for companies to kind of get their head around what exactly is the issue that they're dealing with here.
Yes. And Quinta, I guess what I would add is the idea that a foreign nation has decided that a U.S. company possesses some knowledge that would be valuable to know. And so, and when I say knowledge, knowledge that the U.S. company hasn't made public. And so the foreign government then will do whatever it, and I don't mean all foreign governments, of course, but certain foreign governments will basically say, you know, we need to do what we can to obtain what this particular business knows. And it isn't, when they decide upon that, it isn't like they you know, decide, let's go and get this via cyber means, or let's go and get this via human means, or it's really, we need to obtain that information, that knowledge, let's go get it. And then a sophisticated intelligence service can decide how best to try to obtain what they want to obtain. And sometimes they try a variety of things concurrently. Sometimes they try via one means and that's not successful. And then they'll try via, of course, another approach. But the bottom line is that they've identified something of value and they will use whatever means are necessary to try to get it. And because they're extremely capable and have basically limitless resources to do so, if they really want it, they're going to leave no stone unturned in trying to obtain it.
And so I'd love to give a sense of what countries we have in mind here. You write in your series at one point about China. Is China the main entity that's engaging in this kind of activity? Are there others? You hint that in your first piece that it's authoritarian countries, but also some non-authoritarian countries as well. I'd love to hear you expand on that.
Sure. So, I mean, I think it's probably fair to say that China's at the vanguard. You know, they're sort of the tip of the spear at this point. They're doing things in sort of a novel way and at a level that's really kind of unparalleled by anyone else. But, you know, I want to be a little bit careful. There's keep ourselves on the unclassified side here. But in the kind of open source record, there's a number of pieces. So former Defense Secretary Gates has testified on this even as far as almost like 30 years ago, I believe, and has done numerous talks about this. But, you know, I mean, naming it upwards of, you know, around 20 countries kind of all over the world that do this, and including, I mean, in his estimation, I think back in 2014, he was talking about France as being sort of right behind China. So you have even allies that are doing this and partners. And I think that's kind of an important point, is that this division that the U.S. makes of, you know, essentially not using its spy and intelligence services to gather economic information for commercial gain is kind of unique. We're a bit of an outlier. There's some other countries that also do this, or rather that don't do this, that have kind of a ban against it. But the vast majority of countries, whether they actually engage in it, don't see that as a problem. So in their mind, you know, this economic information is incredibly important for their national development, right? And again, this national development is what gives them security and what is important. These are kind of the basic tenets of government. And so in their mind, taking that information to build up their own sort of national champions makes complete sense. So I think, you know, Gates describes, you know, France as sort of a mercantilist country that has their own sort of state champions and would commonly do this. I think there's examples from the early 90s of even the Germans participating in this and taking information from IBM, I believe it was back in the day. So there's a number of historical examples of where, you know, even our allies have participated in this. That's not to say that everyone's kind of continuing to do it now. But I think what's important to think about is sort of structurally what it looks like. You know, getting this information, conducting this very expensive research and development, science and technology, it takes a lot of effort, a lot of money. And it is much cheaper often to just steal that information from other countries, to take it from companies itself. So it's often much safer to do that than sort of doing it. There is little attribution. The chances of getting caught are probably pretty low. And there's people are overwhelmed with the amount of processes or individuals that are trying this throughout the world. And so it's likely to continue to expand because there's few restrictions on it. And as I said, the U.S. is kind of an outlier in believing that we shouldn't be stealing things for commercial gain, giving it to our companies.
Quinta, so Holden is exactly right in that there frankly are numerous countries that engage in this activity, but at least in my mind, four really big ones. We already mentioned China, but also Russia, Iran, and even North Korea. I saw an article just this past weekend about suspected North Korean hackers targeting a COVID-19 vaccine maker. But again, part of our hesitation in naming certain countries is that then people might misconstrue what we're trying to say and say, oh, it's only those countries currently engaging it. When again, former Secretary of Defense Gates said it could be upwards of 20-some countries. And frankly, as the world becomes more competitive and chaotic, I would expect the list of countries that are engaging in this type of activity to grow.
There's a lot there that I want to dig into, but before we do, just one note, since you did mention a possible vaccine for coronavirus, would you expect that this kind of espionage activity is going to increase over the next few months as efforts to manufacture and deliver a vaccine are scaling up?
Sure. I certainly would expect it to increase. And so first of all, efforts to obtain a vaccine and obviously to help protect and inoculate your citizenry is really, really important. But related, of course, is just think of the economic damage that countries have suffered as a result of this pandemic. And, the activity, this illicit activity to try to gain economic or business advantage, in our opinion, was extremely robust before the pandemic. But basically, with countries now being arguably even more desperate, in seeking economic advancement, growth, gain, you name it, as we come out of the pandemic, I would be shocked if this type of illicit activity doesn't exponentially increase. It's basically you're going to have even more desperate nations doing more desperate things to gain advantage however they possibly can.
I think that you hit the nail on the head with that, Bill. I mean, it's this, the connect, people have realized this, the very connectedness of the world, which has brought so many benefits, is all, there are also avenues for things like COVID-19. And the people are realizing, I think countries are realizing how extremely vulnerable they are to these types of external shocks, and they simply aren't prepared. And so they're going to be looking, and if other countries aren't going to be sharing that information, or even if they would, they're going to be looking to protect their citizenry and essentially their national health, which they'll consider a big part of their national security. So I completely agree. This is just going to increase, and it's going to get even more chaotic.
Before we move on, I want to dig in a little more to this question of the U.S. kind of being apart from other nations in terms of how it conceptualizes a division between economic power and the proper role of espionage. And as part of that, I want to play devil's advocate for a little bit. So let's say, I'm one of the countries, any country, pick or choose, that takes the view that it's appropriate for my state intelligence service to seek information from abroad to sort of help my home economic powerhouses grow and help my country's national security. And I want to say, the United States pretends that it doesn't engage in this kind of thing, but is that really true, right? So like over the last 4 years, we've seen a lot of actions from the Trump administration that seem to sort of conceptualize U.S. economic power as overlapping with national security and as an area that's appropriate for the state to involve itself. You can point to, for example, tariffs that the administration has imposed as a matter of national security under Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act, We could also talk about efforts to force a sale of the China-based app TikTok, that kind of thing. So let's say, you know, if I'm a country that engages in this kind of activity, I could point to all that and say, you know, the U.S. is absolutely playing the same game here in terms of leveraging state power to support U.S. businesses. Why, in your view, is that wrong?
Well, I think that's a complicated question, a complicated answer, I guess. I think there's a couple of things you need to sort of break apart here. That's not to say that the U.S. is not concerned with the economics and that the national security does not play a role in economics. But I think the line that we've kind of drawn and the reasoning behind it is a little bit different, right? So the line we have is that information won't be taken for commercial gain. So what that means is that could that be taken for other reasons? Could you take economic information that wouldn't be used for commercial gain? So it leaves a little bit of an open question there when you make it a very specific sort of goal. And I'll leave it at that. But I think the reason we don't engage in that has more probably to do with our own sort of economic structure rather than for a national security reason. Right? So let's just kind of take a hypothetical and the U.S. began to engage in this and the U.S. took information for commercial gain. Which company would we give that to, right? So how would we decide which company is going to get that extremely critical piece of you know, research or data or things like that? How would we decide which would be our sort of national champion? The idea is a little bit anathema to, you know, sort of the basic economic structure that we have in the United States. I would say, you know, and not trying to provide any defense necessarily for what the administration is doing, but what they're mostly looking at is the playing field. There's some specific concerns about, say, TikTok or other companies that may give them access to, you know, very sensitive information on Americans. But a lot of this, the policy, be it trade or other things that's coming out from the current administration, the endeavor is really about the playing field itself, the environment, right? How do we want the economic environment in the United States to look? It's less about picking particular companies themselves and building them up to be essentially extensions of the government, right? So that's what really the national champion sort of, you know, functions as. If you look at it in other countries, you know, it might be a state-owned enterprise in say a country like China, but it doesn't have to be. Huawei is a great example of that. You can have private and public companies, but essentially they are extensions of government power. And it's very easy in their system to decide that they would kind of pick which one and to support and supplement those companies as necessary. We start to get into really kind of things that are breaking kind of basic tenets of our economic policy that make it very difficult to do that.
Let me answer it a little bit differently. And it, based on frankly, on my experience with the FBI, which, of course, as you know, is both a law enforcement and an intelligence organization. Well, what is law enforcement? A law enforcement organization primarily concerned with? Well, at least in my experience, they're trying to bring wrongdoers to justice. And never once am I aware of an example that I was exposed to in which law enforcement was trying to help a company, a business, gain an economic advantage. On the other side, when it comes to intelligence or intelligence organizations, and at least when I think of the U.S. intelligence community, I think of their primary responsibility as being about collecting intelligence, making sense of it, and providing it to our senior policy and decision makers so that in government so that they can make the most informed decisions as possible on behalf of our nation. It's a long way of saying that the intelligence community is trying to obtain intelligence for policymakers. They are not focused on collecting, analyzing, or providing intelligence that is giving our businesses, you know, some type of economic advantage. This is not to say that law enforcement or intelligence organizations don't sometimes provide information to businesses about threats, but that's done to protect against known or suspected illicit activity, you know, from a foreign nation targeting a particular company or group of companies. That information is not given by the government, at least in my experience, to a business. Again, in order to give it an economic advantage, it's given to protect it from nefarious activity. And so, again, in my years in a law enforcement and intelligence organization, that's what the focus was on when we were doing those things. It was not ever on trying to help an individual business or group of businesses gain an economic advantage.
Your answers kind of get to this, I think, but I want to dig into it a little more. So you read in your first piece that U.S. businesses are decidedly not supported by U.S. government spy agencies. And then later you say the interests of the U.S. government and those of private companies overlap to some degree, but not entirely. I think your answers just now have given listeners a good sense of why that is. But I'd like to explore how those dynamics play out in an instance where, say, a U.S. business is targeted by a foreign intelligence agency and has, you know, intellectual property stolen. Why is it that those interests between the government and the company don't overlap?
So let me try to address the why they don't overlap. I think because ultimately the goals of the government are a bit different from the goals of the company, right? You think about it, sort of a broad perspective, the U.S. government is trying to protect U.S. national security. And what does that mean? That means that, again, getting back to this idea of a playing field and how our economic structures and how that works, it's really about protecting that open, fair playing field. It's not about protecting any individual company. I think that most people would be horrified if our economy ever became so dependent on one particular company that the U.S. needed to defend that company in order for us to still have economic security. And so the ultimate goal there is really national security, right? And so they're focused on, what in the government parlance, would call it the adversary, right? They're focused on the threat actor, the wrongdoer, the person who's the spy, who's trying to steal something from the company. And they're focused on stopping them and trying to potentially prosecute them or arrest them or some sort of mitigation effort. Now contrast that with a company. What is their goal? What do they exist to do? Sort of at a base level, you might say, well, it's a money making machine, right? They're just generating profits. But companies also, they have values and missions that they may be helping guide them in their activities. But it's rare that you'd have a company that is sort of is making high-end semiconductors, and that also says, hey, our goals are to support national security. That may be a kind of an auxiliary or secondary goal of them, that they hope to do that with their business, but that's not their main goal. And so when you look at sort of the, kind of long-term trajectories of what they're trying to do, it's very different. And how does that play out in a specific case? So there are situations in which you might have an ongoing issue. Maybe you have, there's has been an intrusion. It could be an actual person who's intruding, or it could be on a cyber intrusion. Ultimately, it's much easier for the government to, they're looking at prosecution or getting that individual. Whether that happens prior to or after the actual loss of intellectual property or of trade secrets or assets, it's not irrelevant. But and in some ways, it makes it easier after they've actually had an experience of loss. The evidence is there. It's much easier to kind of marshal that, to take it to court. That's not to say that the government isn't interested in prevention, but ultimately they're interested in trying to capture the bad guys. Where the company themselves, they may support the government's and applaud the government's efforts to get these individual actors who are coming after them or to try to stymie their efforts. They're really about protecting the assets of their own company. And so while those interests, you can see how they overlap, there'd be times in which, where for the government, they've got bigger kind of endeavors or more things they're concerned about say a particular threat actor or a particular country, which might make them want to make decisions that are not necessarily in the company's best interests, but they might be in the best interests of the national security of the United States. In contrast, a company may want to make decisions to protect shareholder value, to protect the jobs of their employees, and to ensure that their company is an ongoing concern. But that may not serve the needs of the national security. They may want to just fire the employee rather than set up an elaborate investigation, because that's the surest way to ensure that person won't be able to steal that information. So you can see that there is a dynamic there at times in which the government and the private sector don't always have the same goals or the same interests at heart. Largely, they're in the same area, but there's times at which they're going to differ. And for that reason, we really wanted to encourage companies to start to think about this for themselves so they can protect the equities that are most important to them. And getting to kind of the first part of your question, which is, you know, the government, you know, as we said in our first piece, that the government really can't help. It's not to say that the government would want to help. It's really a matter of resources that are available. If you think about the sheer number of incidents that are ongoing, I think, you know, Director Ray, this has been an often quoted statistic now that it's the FBI is opening a case every 10 hours. If you think that that's just the cases they're opening, right? There's a huge number of incidents, and that's just related to China, not to anyone else. So you've got really an overwhelming number of incidents happening. They simply do not have the resources to go after every single one of these. So what do? They look at what's the best way to protect the playing field, to protect the economic security and the structure itself, not the individual companies.
The only thing I'd add, I thought that was a very well said, but is just the idea that, and frankly, it's part of what's driving Holden and I to write the pieces we're writing, because the government and the businesses have different, call them goals, missions, objectives, what have you. And because the government doesn't have the resources to protect all the things it wants to protect, we're hoping to provide some information to businesses that might help them better protect themselves. So not for a second do we think the government is dropping the ball in this regard. They just can't protect all the things that need to be protected. And so the more we can help businesses protect themselves, frankly, the better we'll feel about what we're trying to do.
So what does it look like then for businesses to protect themselves in the way that you're describing? I think it's interesting because in your second piece, you suggest that you're kind of advising businesses to start thinking about counterintelligence, which is usually something that we think about as, you know, something that's in the purview of the state. So what does it look like to engage in counterintelligence if you're a private enterprise?
I would say that first and foremost, it requires acknowledging the gravity of the threat, the gravity of the problem that we're facing today. I think that there's more awareness about the, let's call it, the nation state intelligence threat than there ever has been, you know, certainly over my long career, that there's as much awareness about these issues as truly as there have ever been. And I don't just mean in government, I mean in the private sector. But unfortunately, one of the things I've heard quite a bit over the last year and a half since I've been gone is the idea, I get it, it's a bad problem and companies need to be aware of it, but not my company. In effect, I'm covered, but others, they probably need to do more in this regard. And so when I say acknowledge the gravity of the threat, I don't mean just understand that, it's a threat and it's out there and some of our businesses are being targeted, but the acknowledgement that depending on what your business does, that it could likely already be being targeted. I often tell people if you have a business and you're a world leader in that business, and I don't care what that business is, I don't care if you make semiconductors or you make pencils, if you're a world leader, chances are pretty high that a foreign nation's intelligence service, at least one foreign nation's, but maybe more, would be interested in knowing how you do what you do. What I'm trying to say is that, at least in my experience and in my opinion, the problem is far more prevalent than I think a lot of businesses want to acknowledge.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think it's really a matter of them understanding their assets and how they fit into the particular plans of various nation states. Take China again, because it's just such an easy example. they actually put out lists of things that they are looking for, things that they want. You've had the president of the Chinese Academy of Sciences who recently talked about a sort of list of technology that they're after. And so I think that this is something that companies just to be, they really need to change what they're looking at and their understanding of that it can't just be geopolitics, can't be an afterthought, or they think about it whenever they're entering a new market. But they really have to be aware of this and understanding that in many cases, even if they don't know they have a competitor, say in China, they likely do. So, you know, your China strategy, quote unquote, isn't simply just, you know, hey, do we have a business in China and how are we going to operate and how are we going to make money there? It's really how do you compete with whatever Chinese national champion there is everywhere else in the world? So this is starting to become more and more of an issue for the companies as they understand it, that they're going to have to see who their competitor is and understand that they're being backed by the foreign government or by the Chinese government in all these various other places throughout the world. They're going to have a better understanding of what they're after and what, again, as Bill said, if they're a world leader, they're going to be interested in all sorts of things from, you know, the know-how within the company, their the most important suppliers, their key employees, even just expansion plans for the next couple of years. All this very sort of what they might normally think of as very mundane business information could be extremely, extremely valuable to give a competitive edge to another company.
I think too often certain companies will think, if my company doesn't produce advanced technology or products or technology related for the military, what have you, well, then, you know, a foreign nation and their intelligence services wouldn't be interested in what I'm doing. But I think what Holden's really getting at is a key point that unfortunately often, I think, is too often lost. But it's this idea that U.S. businesses are competing with businesses of other foreign nations around the world. So one of the things, if you're a U.S. business, that I would ask that you, in effect that you ask yourself is your business competing with a foreign company, a foreign rival for market dominance, you know, any place in the world, and especially outside of our country? And then ask yourself, you know, what is your confidence level that foreign rival and the foreign government that they answer to are going to play by the rules? And so again, even if your company doesn't produce, you know, this advanced technology or stuff related to, you know, to military superiority, countries want their companies to be successful in a variety of places around the world. And many will cut corners to support their companies. In other words, some governments won't play by the rules in efforts to support their companies, again, operating in a variety of places. I guess what I'm trying to say is this is as much about economic advancement and market dominance as it is the particular thing companies produce. Yes, it matters what companies produce, and some of those things are going to be more sought after because of their applicability in a variety of realms. But it's also about just having successful companies, and not everybody's going to play by the rules to develop successful companies.
I just want to make it clear that Bill and I are not, we talk about foreign kind of companies and operating in foreign markets, and the reason we're focused on that and not necessarily just the United States, and not because we're trying to be particularly xenophobic about the issues, but it's because there is a certain amount of, there is legal protections, there's a certain amount of transparency and predictability within the U.S. legal market. And there are other markets in the world that also have that same sort of transparency and predictability. The big change that's happening, as Bill sort of alluded to, is that it's fewer and fewer. There's more and more places now that are susceptible to all sorts of outside influence. And so where a market might have been somewhat transparent and somewhat predictable before, that's going in the opposite direction now. And so companies need to be aware of this, is that these places where they could operate in one way in times past, that's going to be very different now. The competition is going to be very different in those places that are much more susceptible to outside influence. And so we're focused on that because essentially the world is becoming a lot more chaotic and competitive outside the United States. Certainly that's happening a bit within our own country. I mean, as we've seen, we've got all sorts of forces and pressures going on right now. But I think it's extremely prevalent outside, where you've had a lot more sort of brittle and less strong institutions in various countries throughout the world. And so that's why we're really trying to get companies to understand that it's going to be coming from everywhere and when they're operating outside the United States.
You give a very, I think, visceral example of the dangers here in the third piece you wrote, which is about retaliatory detentions in China. And you wrote specifically that, you know, there's that same kind of thinking that, you know, well, other people might be at risk, but I'm not at risk because I'm not prominent enough, or I'm very prominent, or I know enough high-level officials. Can you talk a little bit about how you think people should understand that risk of traveling to China? And you write at the beginning that, you know, you will not be surprised if an American business person is detained. Just talk through that and how it connects to what we've been discussing.
Sure. So I think the best way to think about this is that to some degree, this has already been going on. And we talk about it in the piece that China uses law enforcement and their intelligence services purely for the goals of really the party at the end of the day. It might say the government, but really it's the party that matters and the party's long-term trajectory. And what that means is that you shouldn't be thinking of their security services there, the law enforcement services there as seeking justice. They're looking to use that in any way necessary in order to advance the goals of their national security. So they already do things like keep people in hotels, ban them from leaving the country. The government has participated in this. Sometimes it looks the other way when, you know, you've had a Chinese competitor was formerly a partner with an American company that has detained a representative from the United States until they got more favorable conditions within their partnership. But that's been going on for quite some time. And people have kind of looked the other way for that and say, look, this just isn't likely to affect us, or the market is just too good, or the profits are too good. But what we had is really a significant shift, where China's always really pushed back very hard on any time that there was allegations that they were arresting or taking any kind of law enforcement action as retaliation or to send them a political message. They never really admitted to that. This is very different, where they're actually saying that they plan on taking retaliatory action. And so I think this is really should be a wake-up call to American businesses and to others who travel to China on a regular basis. National security, as Xi Jinping has just made very clear in a lot of a series of recent meetings, plenum, et cetera, is really the core of almost all actions that they're taking. Their security has primacy over, in many cases, the economic development. And so they want to ensure that, if necessary, they will, you know, utilize individuals who are over there to send a message to the United States. So who that could affect, I think, is really difficult to predict. You know, we said it's likely to be someone within a U.S. business just because of the sheer number of individuals over there. And China also often likes to keep things in sort of a symmetrical response, right? You have Meng Wanzhou, the CFO for Huawei, who was arrested in Canada and going to be extradited to the United States or is in process. And so it's likely to be someone on the business side of things. When that happens, how they do it, do they already have the person in mind? Are they just waiting for them to travel? All of these things are possible. My guess is it's unlikely to be something that would be a shoot from the hip, sort of, that they already have a list of individuals that would make a good example, and they're just simply waiting for the right opportunity as well as the timing. And that could happen to either, you know, sort of test the new administration right after inauguration, or it might happen before to kind of send a message to the new administration that if you continue to arrest our people in the United States, this is the sort of response you're going to get. And so it's really unclear what they're going to say. But I think the idea that as we make in the piece is that the U.S. is not going to stop arresting these individuals. And so it's just going to be a matter of time before China will have a response, which will be a similar arrest.
I wanted to close by zooming out a little bit and talking about why it is that you think businesses and perhaps Americans generally have been slow to understand the dynamic and the dangers that we've described here. You write in one point this really interesting line, which I want to read, which is, many counterintelligence practitioners wondered whether Russia's interference in the 2016 election might be a 9/11 type event, an occurrence so dramatic and traumatizing to the nation and its core values that it would stimulate a response, an attack that would help crystallize in the minds of Americans how much their world had changed and how precarious their position in it was. And then you say, that did not happen. So talk this through with me a little bit. Why didn't it happen? Why is it that counterintelligence threats are sort of difficult to understand?
Why don't I begin with the idea that the impact of intelligence threats are usually only gradually felt. So unlike, you know, either, you know, violent crime or kind of related terrorist activities, what have you, when someone succeeds in an intelligence sense, there's literally and figuratively no blood in the streets. Just as a quick example, if I steal cutting edge technology from a, and I'm on behalf of a foreign nation, I steal cutting edge technology from a U.S. company today, that U.S. company doesn't feel any pain today. I didn't destroy any of their buildings. I didn't physically harm any of their people. They might not even know that again, I've walked off with the information that's so valuable. And frankly, on the day I walk off with it, I can't immediately put it to use. I have to assemble a team, you know, back overseas to make sense of it. We then have to decide how we're going to implement the, in effect, you know, the knowledge we've illicitly gained. And then even when I do implement that knowledge, and sometimes it's to compete in the open market against the very company that was stolen from, even when I do that, I don't immediately cut into the profits of the company that was stolen from. It's only slowly over time, if I successfully implement my, again, my newfound knowledge or new stolen knowledge, can I eat into that company's profits. But what I'm getting at is because the impact is so gradual, there just isn't the human visceral reaction to the wrongdoing that I think there is in a lot of other regards.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think that it's not felt as acutely as say a terrorist event or a, you know, some kind of violent attack. And you know, in that case, we're obviously talking about election interference. And so maybe some people are kind of scratching their heads and say, well, what does election interference have to do with, you know, economic espionage? To us, they're also just two sides of the same coin. Essentially, these are often the same organizations in other countries that are doing something in a slightly different manner. Essentially, what they're doing is they're interfering in a particular process, right? What Americans should recognize from this is that these processes, because they were remote, they were far away, it was difficult to influence them. It would take too many resources. It would be to do it. They were safe. So sort of like the election, right? So, or even having some, you know, distributing to information warfare that Russia conducting to sort of to deepen the divisions within the country. That was such a remote possibility. But what's changed that we talked about a little bit is this proliferation of the tools and tactics that are traditionally in the purview of the intelligence services. This ability to manipulate information, spread disinformation, this ability to reach out and touch individuals from all over the world, and to really kind of get at the very specifics within their life. This is a very different type of world that Americans are now living with that they didn't see before. And that plays out not only in kind of election, where you might have an individual you're interacting with, is maybe it's a bot that's, you know, operating out of Russia. Maybe it's an individual, you know, who's actually in St. Petersburg that you're interacting with. You don't really know that, right? And so that's a new type of threat in your world, that the information you're getting from this person or this may not actually be have your best interest at heart, and they may not even really care about the debate. They're just looking to influence you in a particular way. So similarly, the threat from spy services and from foreign countries has pervaded into the economic sphere, where you've seen their ability to kind of reach deep into companies, reach to contact specific employees, to influence them, to blackmail them in some circumstances, but basically to exploit them and to use them to get the economic information, the intellectual property, the data they want from these companies. So that shift has been pretty significant, and it's happened a little bit, kind of as Bill's mentioned, it happens over a long period of time. And so people sort of get inured to each day a little bit changes, and it sort of says, well, that's always how it's been. But this is really difficult, I think, for people to realize is that, you go back 20, 30 years, this never happened. It just the technology or the ability to reach out and do this was really not there. Certainly, was it attempted at lower levels? Absolutely. But it's never had the same sort of widespread contact with the American populace that it does now. And so this is something that people need to think about, that in the same way that they sort of kind of inculcated the idea that terrorism is potentially an ever-present kind of concern at varying levels, depending on where you are and what you're doing. But this is a new concern with it. Not only might your elections be interfered with, or your information might be manipulated or changed or put in a way to kind of elicit a response from you, but they might actually be going out after you so they can get at economic data in the company that you work for, or they might, taking information to exploit you in a particular way. All of these kind of threats are very new to the majority of Americans, even if to a small segment of the population in government or in intelligence services, they've always been there. It's just so much more widespread now.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Bill and Holden, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer is Zachary Frank. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And our producer is Jen Pache Howell. Please give us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.